Chapter 5. Welcome to Town. 1. Two nights after arriving in the barony of Magus, Roland, Cuthbert, and Alain rode their mounts beneath an adobe arch with the words "Come in Peace" inscribed above it. Beyond was a cobblestone courtyard lit with torches. The resin which coated these had been doctored somehow, so that the torches glowed different colors, green, orangey red, a kind of sputtery pink that made Roland think of fireworks. He could hear the sound of guitars, the murmur of voices, the laughter of women. The air was redolent of those smells which would always remind him of Magus, sea salt, oil, and pine. "I don't know if I can do this," Alain muttered. He was a big boy, with a mop of unruly blonde hair spilling out from under his stockman's hat. He had cleaned up well, they all had, but Alain, no social butterfly under the best of circumstances, looked scared to death. Cuthbert was doing better, but Roland guessed his old friend's patina of insouciance didn't go very deep. If there was to be leading done here, he would have to do it. "You'll be fine," he told Alain. "Oh, he looks fine," Cuthbert said, with a nervous laugh, as they crossed the courtyard. Beyond it was Mayor's house, a sprawling, many-winged adobe hacienda that seemed to spill light and laughter from every window. "White as a sheet, ugly as a shut-up," Roland said curtly, and the teasing smile tumbled off Cuthbert's face at once. Roland noted this, then turned to Alain again. "Just don't drink anything with alcohol in it. You know what to say on that account. Remember the rest of our story, too. Smile, be pleasant, use what social graces you have. Remember how the sheriff fell all over himself to make us feel welcome." Alain nodded at that, looking a little more confident. "In the matter of social graces," Cuthbert said, "they won't have many themselves, so we should all be a step ahead." Roland nodded, then saw that the bird's skull was back on the horn of Cuthbert's saddle. "And get rid of that." Looking guilty, Cuthbert stuffed the lookout hurriedly into his saddlebag. Two men wearing white jackets, white pants, and sandals were coming forward, bowing and smiling. "Keep your heads," Roland said, lowering his voice. "Both of you remember why you're here, and remember the faces of your fathers." He clapped Alain, who still looked doubtful, on the shoulder. Then he turned to the hostlers. "Good even, gents," he said. "May your days be long upon the earth." They both grinned, their teeth flashing in the extravagant torchlight. The older one bowed. "And your own as well, young masters. Welcome to Mayor's house." 2. The High Sheriff had welcomed them the day before every bit as happily as the hostlers. So far, everyone had greeted them happily, even the carters they had passed on their way into town. And that alone made Roland feel suspicious and on his guard. He told himself he was likely being foolish. Of course the locals were friendly and helpful. That was why they had been sent here, because Magus was both out of the way and loyal to the affiliation. And it probably was foolish. But he thought it best to be on close watch just the same. To be a trifle nervous. The three of them were little more than children, after all, and if they fell into trouble here, it was apt to be as a result of taking things at face value. The combined sheriff's office and jail of barony was on Hill Street, overlooking the bay. Roland didn't know for sure, but guessed that few, if any, hungover drunks and wife-beaters anywhere else in Midworld woke up to such picturesque views. A line of many-colored boathouses to the south, the docks directly below, with boys and old men line-fishing while the women mended nets and sails. Beyond them, Hambry's small fleet moving back and forth on the sparkling blue water of the bay, setting their nets in the morning, pulling them in the afternoon. Most buildings on the high street were adobe, but up here, overlooking Hambry's business section, they were as squat and bricky as any narrow lane in Gilead's old quarter. Well kept, too, with wrought-iron gates in front of most and tree-shaded paths. The roofs were orange tile, the shutters closed against the summer sun. It was hard to believe, riding down this street with their horses' hoofs clocking on the swept cobbles, that the northwestern side of the affiliation, the ancient land of Eld, Arthur's kingdom, could be on fire and in danger of falling. The jailhouse was just a larger version of the post office and land office, a smaller version of the town gathering hall. Except, of course, for the bars on the windows facing down toward the small harbor. Sheriff Herc Avery was a big-bellied man in a lawman's khaki pants and shirt. He must have been watching them approach through the spy hole in the center of the jail's iron-banded front door, because the door was thrown open before Roland could even reach for the turn bell in the center. Sheriff Avery appeared on the stoop, his belly preceding him as a bailiff may precede my lord judge into court. His arms were thrown wide in the most amiable of greetings. He bowed deeply to them. Cuthbert said later he was afraid the man might overbalance and go rolling down the steps, perhaps go rolling all the way down to the harbor, and wished them repeated good morns, tapping away at the base of his throat like a madman the whole while. His smile was so wide it looked as if it might cut his head clean in two. Three deputies with a distinctly farmerish look about them, dressed in khaki like the sheriff, crowded into the door behind Avery and gawked. That was what it was, all right, a gawk. There was just no other word for that sort of openly curious and totally unself-conscious stare. Avery shook each boy by the hand, continuing to bow as he did so, and nothing Roland said could get him to stop until he was done. When he finally was, he showed them inside. The office was delightfully cool in spite of the beating midsummer sun. That was the advantage of brick, of course. It was big as well, and cleaner than any high sheriff's office Roland had ever been in before, and he had been in at least half a dozen over the last 3 years, accompanying his father on several short trips and one longer patrol swing. There was a roll-top desk in the center, a notice board to the right of the door, the same sheets of foolscap had been scribbled on over and over, paper was a rare commodity in Midworld, and in the far corner two rifles in a padlocked case. These were such ancient blunderbusses that Roland wondered if there was ammunition for them. He wondered if they would fire, come to that. To the left of the gun case, an open door gave on the jail itself, three cells on each side of a short corridor, and a smell of strong lye soap drifting out. They've cleaned for our coming, Roland thought. He was amused, touched, and uneasy. Cleaned it as though we were a troop of inner barony horse, career soldiers who might want to stage a hard inspection instead of three lads serving punishment detail. But was such nervous care on the part of their hosts really so strange? They were from New Canaan, after all, and folk in this tucked-away corner of the world might well see them as a species of visiting royalty. Sheriff Avery introduced his deputies. Roland shook hands with all of them, not trying to memorize their names. It was Cuthbert who took care of names, and it was a rare occasion when he dropped one. The third, a bald fellow with a monocle hanging around his neck on a ribbon, actually dropped to one knee before them.
"Don't do that, you great idiot!"
Avery cried, yanking him back up by the scruff of his neck.
"What kind of a bumpkin will they think you? Besides, you've embarrassed them, so you have."
"That's all right," Roland said. He was, in fact, very embarrassed, although trying not to show it. "We're really nothing at all special, you know."
"Nothing special?" Avery said, laughing.
His belly, Roland noticed, did not shake as one might have expected it to do. It was harder than it looked. The same might be true of its owner.
"Nothing special," he says. 500 mile or more from the in-world they've come. Our first official visitors from the affiliation since a gunslinger passed through on the Great Road 4 years ago, and yet he says they're nothing special. Would you sit, my boys? I've got graph, which you won't want so early in the day. Perhaps not at all, given your ages. And if you'll forgive me for stating so bald the obvious fact of your youth, for youth's not a thing to be ashamed of, so it's not. We were all young once. And I also have white iced tea, which I recommend most hearty, as Dave's wife makes it, and she's a dab hand with most any potable.
Roland looked at Cuthbert and Alan, who nodded and smiled and tried not to look all at sea. Then back at Sheriff Avery. White tea would go down a treat in a dusty throat, he said. One of the deputies went to fetch it. Chairs were produced and set in a row at one side of Sheriff Avery's roll-top, and the business of the day commenced.
"You know who you are and where you hail from, and I know the same,"
Sheriff Avery said, sitting down in his own chair. It uttered a feeble groan beneath his bulk, but held steady.
I can hear Inworld in your voices, but more important, I can see it in your faces. Yet we hold to the old ways here in Hambry, sleepy and rural as we may be, we hold to our course and remember the faces of our fathers as well as we can. So although I'd not keep you long from your duties, and if you'll forgive me for the impertinence, I'd like a look at any papers and documents of passage you might just happen to have brought into town with you.
They just happened to have brought all of their papers into town with them, as Roland was sure Sheriff Avery well knew they would. He went through them quite slowly for a man who'd promised not to hold them from their duties, tracing the well-folded sheets, the linen content so high that the documents were perhaps closer to cloth than paper, with one pudgy finger, his lips moving. Every now and then the finger would reverse as he reread a line. The two other deputies stood behind him, looking sagely down over his large shoulders. Roland wondered if either could actually read. William Dearborn, drover's son. Richard Stockworth, rancher's son. Arthur Heath, stockline breeder's son. The identification document belonging to each was signed by an attester, James Reed of Hemphill in the case of Dearborn, Pete Ravenhead of Pendleton in the case of Stockworth, Lucas Rivers of Gilead in the case of Heath. All in order, descriptions nicely matched. The papers were handed back with profuse thanks. Roland next handed Avery a letter, which he took from his wallet with some care. Avery handled it in the same fashion, his eyes growing wide as he saw the franc at the bottom.
"'Pon my soul, boys, 'twas a gunslinger wrote this.'
"'Aye, so it was,'
Cuthbert agreed in a voice of wonder. Roland kicked his ankle hard without taking his respectful eyes from Avery's face. The letter above the franc was from one Stephen Deshane of Gilead, a gunslinger, which was to say a knight, squire, peacemaker, and baron, the last title having almost no meaning in the modern day, despite all John Farson's ranting, of the 29th generation descended from Arthur of Eld on the sideline of descent, the long-descended get of one of Arthur's many gillies, in other words. To Mayor Hartwell Thorin, Chancellor Kimba Rymer, and High Sheriff Herkimer Avery, it sent greetings and recommended to their notice the three young men who delivered this document, Masters Dearborn, Stockworth, and Heath. These had been sent on special mission from the affiliation to serve as counters of all materials which might serve the affiliation in time of need. The word war was omitted from the document, but glowed between every line. Stephen Deshane, on behalf of the affiliation of baronies, exhorted Misters Thorin, Rymer, and Avery to afford the affiliation's nominated counters every help in their service, and to be particularly careful in the enumerations of all livestock, all supplies of food, and all forms of transport. Dearborn, Stockworth, and Heath would be in Mages for at least 3 months, Deshane wrote, possibly as long as a year. The document finished by inviting any or all of the addressed public officials to write us word of these young men and their deportment, in all detail as you shall imagine of interest to us. And, it begged, do not stint in this matter if you love us. Tell us if they behave themselves, in other words. Tell us if they've learned their lesson. The deputy with the monocle came back while the High Sheriff was perusing this document. He carried a tray loaded with 4 glasses of white tea and bent down with it like a butler. Roland murmured thanks and handed the glasses around. He took the last for himself, raised it to his lips, and saw Alain looking at him, his blue eyes bright in his stolid face. Alain shook his glass slightly, just enough to make the ice tinkle, and Roland responded with the barest sliver of a nod. He had expected cool tea from a jug kept in a nearby springhouse, but there were actual chunks of ice in the glasses. Ice in high summer. It was interesting. And the tea was, as promised, delicious. Avery finished the letter and handed it back to Roland with the air of one passing on a holy relic.
You want to keep that safe about your person, Will Dearborn? Aye, very safe indeed.
Yes, sir. He tucked the letter and his identification back into his purse. His friends Richard and Arthur were doing the same.
"This is excellent white tea, sir," Alan said. "I've never had better."
"Aye," Avery said, sipping from his own glass. "'Tis the honey that makes it so fearsome, eh, Dave?"
The deputy with the monocle smiled from his place by the notice board.
"I believe so, but Judy don't like to say. She had the recipe from her mother."
"Aye, we must remember the faces of our mothers, too, so we must."
Sheriff Avery looked sentimental for a moment, but Roland had an idea that the face of his mother was the furthest thing from the big man's mind just then. He turned to Alain, and sentiment was replaced by a surprising shrewdness.
"You're wondering about the ice, Master Stockworth."
Alain started.
"Well, he expected no such amenity in a backwater like Hambry, I'll warrant,"
Avery said. And although there was a joshing quality on top of his voice, Roland thought there was something else entirely underneath.
"He doesn't like us. He doesn't like what he thinks of as our city ways. He hasn't known us long enough to know what kind of ways we have, if any at all, but already he doesn't like them. He thinks we're a trio of snot-noses, that we see him and everyone else here as country bumpkins."
"Not just Hambry," Alan said quietly. "Ice is as rare in the inner arc these days as anywhere else, Sheriff Avery. When I grew up, I saw it mostly as a special treat at birthday parties and such."
"There was always ice on Glowing Day," Cuthbert put in. He spoke with very un-Cuthbertian quiet. "Except for the fireworks, that's what we liked about it most."
"Is that so? Is that so?" Sheriff Avery said in an amazed, wonders-will-never-cease tone.
Avery perhaps didn't like them riding in like this. Didn't like having to take up what he would probably call half the damn morning with them. He didn't like their clothes, their fancy identification papers, their accents, or their youth. Least of all, their youth. Roland could understand all that, but wondered if it was the whole story. If there was something else going on here. What was it?
"There's a gas-fired refrigerator and stove in the town gathering hall," Avery said. "Both work. There's plenty of earth gas out at Sitgo. That's the oil patch east of town. You're past it on your way in, I wot."
They nodded.
"Stove's not but a curiosity these days, a history lesson for the schoolchildren. But the refrigerator comes in handy, so it does."
Avery held up his glass and looked through the side.
"Especially in summer."
He sipped some tea, smacked his lips, and smiled at Alain.
"You see? No mystery."
"I'm surprised you haven't found use for the oil," Roland said. "No generators in town, Sheriff?"
"Aye, there be four or five," Avery said. "The biggest is out at Francis Langill's Rocking Bee Ranch, and I recall when it used to run. It's Honda. Do you ken it, that name, boys, Honda?"
"I've seen it once or twice," Roland said, "on old motor-driven bicycles."
"Aye? In any case, none of the generators will run on the oil from the Sitgo patch. 'Tis too thick. Tarry goo is all. We have no refineries here."
"I see," Alain said. "In any case, ice in summer is a treat, however it comes to the glass." He let one of the chunks slip into his mouth and crunched it between his teeth.
Avery looked at him a moment longer, as if to make sure the subject was closed, then switched his gaze back to Roland. His fat face was once more radiant with his broad, untrustworthy smile.
"Mayor Thorin has asked me to extend ye his very best greetings and convey his regrets for not being here today. Very busy is our Lord Mayor, very busy indeed. But he's laid on a dinner party at Mayor's house tomorrow evening. 7 o'clock for most folk, 8 for you young fellas. So you can make a bit of an entrance, I imagine, at a touch of drama-like. And I need not tell such as yourselves, who've probably attended more such parties than I've had hot dinners, that it would be best to arrive pretty much on the dot."
"Is it fancy dress?" Cuthbert asked uneasily. "Because we've come a long way, almost 400 wheels, and we didn't pack formal wear and sashes, none of us." Avery was chuckling. More honestly this time, Roland thought, perhaps because he felt Arthur had displayed a streak of unsophistication and insecurity.
"Nay, young master, Thorin understands ye've come to do a job. Next door to working cowboys ye be, where they don't have ye out dragging nets in the bay next."
From the corner, Dave, the deputy with the monocle, honked unexpected laughter.
Perhaps it was the sort of joke you had to be local to understand, Roland thought.
Wear the best you have and you'll be fine. There'll be no one there in sashes. In any case, that's not how things are done in Hambry.
Again Roland was struck by the man's constant smiling denigration of his town and barony, and the resentment of the outsiders which lay just beneath it.
In any case, ye'll find yourselves working more than playing tomorrow night, I imagine. Hart's invited all the large ranchers, stockliners, and livestock owners from this part of the barony. Not that there's so many, you understand, being as how Magus is next door to desert once you get west of the drop. But everyone whose goods and chattel you've been sent to count will be there. And I think you'll find all of them loyal affiliation men, ready and eager to help. There's Francis Langill of the Rockin' Bee, John Croydon of the Piano Ranch, Henry Wertner, who's the barony's stockliner as well as a horse breeder in his own right, Hash Renfrew, who owns the Lazy Susan, the biggest horse ranch in Magus, not that it's much by the standards you fellas are used to, I wot, and there'll be others as well. Rhymer'll introduce you and get you about your business right smart.
Roland nodded and turned to Cuthbert. You'll want to be on your mettle tomorrow night?
Cuthbert nodded. Don't fear me, Will, I'll know them all.
Avery sipped more tea, eyeing them over his glass with a roguish expression so false it made Roland want to squirm.
Most of 'em's got daughters of marriageable age, and they'll bring 'em. You boys want to look out.
Roland decided he'd had enough tea and hypocrisy for one morning. He nodded, emptied his glass, smiled, hoping his looked more genuine than Avery's now looked to him, and got to his feet. Cuthbert and Alain took the cue and did likewise.
"Thank you for the tea and for the welcome," Roland said. "Please send a message to Mayor Thorin, thanking him for his kindness, and telling him that he'll see us tomorrow at 8 o'clock prompt."
"Aye, so I will."
Roland then turned to Dave. That worthy was so surprised to be noticed again that he recoiled, almost bumping his head on the notice board.
"And please thank your wife for the tea. It was wonderful."
"I will. Thank you, Si."
They went back outside, High Sheriff Avery herding them along like a genial, overweight sheepdog.
"As to where you'll locate," he began as they descended the steps and started down the walk. As soon as they hit the sunshine, he began to sweat.
"Oh, land, I forgot to ask you about that," Roland said, knocking the heel of his hand against his forehead. "We've camped out on that long slope. Lots of horses as you go down the turf. I'm sure you know where I mean."
"The drop, aye."
"But without permission, because we don't yet know who to ask."
"That'd be John Croydon's land, and I'm sure he wouldn't begrudge ye, but we mean to do you better than that. There's a spread northwest of here, the Bar K. Used to belong to the Garber family, but they gave it up and moved on after a fire. Now, it belongs to the Horsemen's Association. That's a little local group of farmers and ranchers. I spoke to Francis Langill about you fellas. He's the H.A. president, just current. And he said we'll put him out to the old Garber place. Why not?"
"Why not?" Cuthbert agreed in a gentle, musing voice. Roland shot him a sharp glance, but Cuthbert was looking down at the harbor, where the small fishing boats skittered to and fro like water bugs.
"Ah, just what I said. Why not indeed, I said. The home place burned to a cinder, but the bunkhouse still stands. So does the stable and the cook shack next door to it. On Mayor Thorin's orders, I've taken the liberty of stocking the larder and having the bunkhouse swept out and spruced up a little. Ye may see the occasional bug, but nothing that'll bite or sting. And no snakes, unless there's a few under the floor. And if there are, let 'em stay there, is what I say. Hey, boys, let 'em stay there."
"Let 'em stay there, right under the floor, where they're happy,"
Cuthbert agreed, still gazing down at the harbor with his arms folded over his chest. Avery gave him a brief, uncertain glance, his smile flickering a bit at the corners. Then he turned back to Roland, and the smile shone out strongly once more.
"There's no holes in the roof, lad, and if it rains, you'll be dry. What think ye of that? Does it sound well to ye?"
"Better than we deserve. I think that you've been very efficient, and Mayor Thorin's been far too kind."
And he did think that. The question was, why?
"But we appreciate his thoughtfulness, don't we, boys?"
Cuthbert and Alain made vigorous assent.
"And we accept with thanks."
Avery nodded.
"I'll tell him. Go safely, boys."
They had reached the hitching rail. Avery once more shook hands all around, this time saving his keenest looks for their horses.
Until tomorrow night, then, young gents?
Tomorrow night, Roland agreed.
Will ye be able to find the barquet on your own, do you think?
Again Roland was struck by the man's unspoken contempt and unconscious condescension. Yet perhaps it was to the good. If the High Sheriff thought they were stupid, who knew what might come of it? We'll find it, Cuthbert said, mounting up. Avery was looking suspiciously at the rook's skull on the horn of Cuthbert's saddle. Cuthbert saw him looking, but for once managed to keep his mouth shut. Roland was both amazed and pleased by this unexpected reticence.
Fare you well, Sheriff. And you, boy?
He stood there by the hitching post, a large man in a khaki shirt with sweat stains around the armpits and black boots that looked too shiny for a working sheriff's feet. And where's the horse that could support him through a day of range riding, Roland thought. I'd like to see the cut of that cayuse. Avery waved to them as they went. The other deputies came down the walk, Deputy Dave in the forefront. They waved, too. 3. The moment the affiliation brats mounted on their father's expensive horseflesh were around the corner and headed downhill to the high street, the sheriff and the deputy stopped waving. Avery turned to Dave Hollis, whose expression of slightly stupid awe had been replaced by one marginally more intelligent.
What, thank you, Dave?
Dave lifted his monocle to his mouth and began to nibble nervously at its brass edging, a habit about which Sheriff Avery had long since ceased to nag him. Even Dave's wife, Judy, had given up on that score, and Judy Hollis, Judy Wertner, that was a fair engine when it came to getting her own way.
Soft, Dave said. Soft as eggs just dropped out of a chicken's ass. Mayhap, Avery said, putting his thumbs in his belt and rocking enormously back and forth. But the one did most of the talking, him in the flathead hat, he doesn't think he's soft. Don't matter what he thinks, Dave said, still nibbling at his eyeglass. He's in Hambry now. He may have to change his way of thinking to ourn.
Behind him, the other deputies laughed. Even Avery smiled. They would leave the rich boys alone if the rich boys left them alone. Those were orders, straight from Mayor's house. But Avery had to admit that he wouldn't mind a little dust-up with them, so he wouldn't. He would enjoy putting his boot into the balls of the one with that idiotic bird skull on his saddle horn, standing there and mocking him, he'd been, thinking all the while that Herc Avery was too country-dumb to know what he was up to. But the thing he'd really enjoy would be beating the cool look from the eyes of the boy in the flathead preacher's hat, seeing a hotter expression of fear rise up in them, as Mr. Will Dearborn of Hemp Hill realized that New Canaan was far away and his rich father couldn't help him.
"Aye," he said, clapping Dave on the shoulder, "mayhap he'll have to change his way of thinking."
He smiled, one very different from any of those he had shown the affiliation counters.
Mayhap they all will.
Four. The three boys rode in single file until they were past the Traveler's Rest. A young and obviously retarded man with kinky black hair looked up from scrubbing the brick stoop and waved to them. They waved back. Then they moved up abreast, Roland in the middle.
"What did you think of our new friend, the High Sheriff?" Roland asked.
"I have no opinion," Cuthbert said brightly.
"Nope, none at all.
Opinion is politics, and politics is an evil which has caused many a fellow to be hung while he's still young and pretty." He leaned forward and tapped the rook's skull with his knuckles. "The lookout didn't care for him, though. I'm sorry to say that our faithful lookout thought Sheriff Avery a fat bag of guts without a trustworthy bone in his body."
Roland turned to Alain. "And you, young Master Stockworth?"
Alain considered it for some time, as was his way, chewing a piece of grass he'd bent over saddle to pluck from his side of the road. At last he said, "If he came upon us burning in the street, I don't think he'd piss on us to put us out."
Cuthbert laughed heartily at that.
"And you will? How do you say, dear Captain?"
"He doesn't interest me much. But one thing he said does. Given that the horse meadow they call the Drop has to be at least 30 wheels long and runs 5 or more to the dusty desert, How do you suppose Sheriff Avery knew we were on the part of it that belongs to Croydon's Piano Ranch? They looked at him, first with surprise, then speculation. After a moment, Cuthbert leaned forward and rapped once more on the rook's skull. We're being watched, and you never reported it? No supper for you, sir, and it'll be the stockade the next time it happens. But before they had gone much farther, Roland's thoughts of Sheriff Avery gave way to more pleasant ones of Susan Delgado. He would see her the following night. Of that he was sure. He wondered if her hair would be down. He couldn't wait to find out. 5. Now here they were, at Mayor's house. Let the game begin, Roland thought, not clear on what that meant, even as the phrase went through his mind, surely not thinking of castles. Not then. The hostlers led their mounts away, and for a moment the three of them stood at the foot of the steps, huddled, almost, as horses do in unfriendly weather, their beardless faces washed by the light of the torches. From inside the guitars played, and voices were raised in a fresh eddy of laughter. "Do we knock?" Cuthbert asked. "Or just open and march in?" Roland was spared answering. The main door of the hussy was thrown open, and two women stepped out, both wearing long white-collared dresses that reminded all three boys of the dresses stockmen's wives wore in their own part of the world. Their hair was caught back in snoods that sparkled with some bright diamondy stuff in the light of the torches. The plumper of the two stepped forward, smiling, and dropped them a deep curtsy. Her earrings, which looked like square-cut fire dims, flashed and bobbed.
"You are the young men from the affiliation, so you are, and welcome you are as well. Good even, sirs, and may your days be long upon the earth."
They bowed in unison, boots forward, and thanked her in an unintended chorus that made her laugh and clap her hands. The tall woman beside her offered them a smile as spare as her frame.
"I am Olive Thorin," the plump woman said, "the mayor's wife. This is my sister-in-law, Coral."
Coral Thorin, still with that narrow smile that barely creased her lips and touched her eyes not at all, dipped them a token curtsy. Roland, Cuthbert, and Alan bowed again over their outstretched legs.
"I welcome you to seafront," Olive Thorin said, her dignity leavened and made pleasant by her artless smile, her obvious dazzlement at the appearance of her young visitors from Inworld. "Come to our house with joy, I say so with all my heart, so I do."
"And so we will, madam," Roland said, "for your greeting has made us joyful." He took her hand, and with no calculation whatever, raised it to his lips and kissed it. Her delighted laughter made him smile. He liked Olive Thorin on sight, and it was perhaps well he met someone of that sort early on, for with the problematic exception of Susan Delgado, he met no one else he liked, no one else he trusted, all that night. 6. It was warm enough, even with the sea breeze, and a cloak and coat collector in the foyer looked as though he'd had little or no custom. Roland wasn't entirely surprised to see that it was Deputy Dave, his remaining bits of hair slicked back with some sort of gleaming grease, and his monocle now lying on the snow-white breast of a houseman's jacket. Roland gave him a nod. Dave, his hands clasped behind his back, returned it. Two men, Sheriff Avery and an elderly gent as gaunt as old Dr. Death in a cartoon, came toward them. Beyond, through a pair of double doors now open wide, a whole room full of people stood about with crystal punch cups in their hands, talking and taking little bits of food from the trays which were circulating. Roland had time for just one narrow-eyed glance toward Cuthbert. Everything, every name, every face, every nuance, especially those. Cuthbert raised an eyebrow, his discreet version of a nod, and then Roland was pulled willy-nilly into the evening, his first real evening of service as a working gunslinger, and he had rarely worked harder. Old Dr. Death turned out to be Kimba Reimer, Thorin's Chancellor and Minister of Inventory. Roland suspected the title had been made up special for their visit. He was easily 5 inches taller than Roland, who was considered tall in Gilead, and his skin was pale as candle wax. Not unhealthy-looking, just pale. Wings of iron gray hair floated away from either side of his head, gossamer as cobwebs. The top of his skull was completely bald. Balanced on his whelk of a nose was a pince-nez. "My boys," he said when the introductions had been made. He had the smooth, sadly sincere voice of a politician or an undertaker. "Welcome to Mages, to Hambry, and to Seafront, our humble mayor's house."
"If this is humble, I should wonder at the palace your folk might build," Roland said. It was a mild enough remark, more pleasantry than witticism. He ordinarily left the wit to Bert. But Chancellor Rymer laughed hard. So did Sheriff Avery.
"Come, boys," Rymer said, when he apparently felt he had expressed enough amusement. "The mayor awaits you with impatience, I'm sure."
"Aye,"
said a timid voice from behind them. The skinny sister-in-law, Coral, had disappeared, but Olive Thorin was still there, looking up at the newcomers with her hands decorously clasped before that area of her body which might once have been her waist. She was still smiling her hopeful, pleasant smile.
"Very eager to meet you, heart is. Very eager indeed.
Shall I conduct them, Kimball?"
Nay, you mustn't trouble yourself with so many other guests to attend," Rymer said.
"I suppose you're right."
She curtsied to Roland and his companions a final time. And although she still smiled, and although the smile looked completely genuine to Roland, he thought, "She's unhappy about something all the same. Desperately so, I think."
"Gentlemen," Rymer asked. The teeth in his smile were almost disconcertingly huge. "Will ye come?"
He led them past the grinning sheriff and into the reception hall. Seven. Roland was hardly overwhelmed by it. He had, after all, been in the Great Hall of Gilead, the Hall of the Grandfathers, it was sometimes called, and had even peeped down on the great party which was held there each year, the so-called Dance of Easterling, which marked the end of Wide Earth and the advent of sowing. There were 5 chandeliers in the great hall instead of just 1, and lit with electric bulbs rather than oil lamps. The dress of the partygoers, many of them expensive young men and women who had never done a hand's turn of work in their lives, a fact of which John Farson spoke at every opportunity, had been richer, the music had been fuller, the company of older and nobler lines which grew closer and closer together as they stretched back toward Arthur Eld, he of the white horse and unifying sword. Yet there was life here, and plenty of it. There was a robustness that had been missing in Gilead, and not just at Easterling either. The texture he felt as he stepped into the mayor's house reception room was the sort of thing, Roland reflected, that you didn't entirely miss when it was gone, because it slipped away quietly and painlessly, like blood from a vein cut in a tub filled with hot water. The room, almost, but not quite grand enough to be a hall, was circular, its paneled walls decorated by paintings, most quite bad, of previous mayors. On a raised stand to the right of the doors leading into the dining area, 4 grinning guitarists in toddy jackets and sombreros were playing something that sounded like a waltz with pepper on it. In the center of the floor was a table supporting 2 cut-glass punch bowls, one vast and grand, the other smaller and plainer. The white-jacketed fellow in charge of the dipping-out operations was another of Avery's deputies. Contrary to what the High Sheriff had told them the day before, several of the men were wearing sashes of various colors, but Roland didn't feel too out of place in his white silk shirt, black string tie, and 1 pair of stovepipe dress trousers. For every man wearing a sash, he saw 3 wearing the sort of dowdy, box-tailed coats that he associated with stockmen at church, and he saw several others, younger men for the most part, who weren't wearing coats at all. Some of the women wore jewelry, though nothing so expensive as Cy Thorin's fire-dim earrings, and few looked as if they'd missed many meals, but they also wore clothes Roland recognized.
The long, round-collared dresses, usually with the lace fringe of a colored underskirt showing below the hem, the dark shoes with low heels, the snoods, most sparkling with gem dust, as those of Olive and Coral Thorin had been. And then he saw one who was very different. It was Susan Delgado, of course, shimmering and almost too beautiful to look at, in a blue silk dress with a high waist and a square-cut bodice which showed the tops of her breasts. Around her neck was a sapphire pendant that made Olive Thorin's earrings look like paste. She stood next to a man wearing a sash the color of coals in a hot wood fire. That deep orange-red was the barony's color, and Roland supposed that the man was their host. But for the moment Roland barely saw him. His eye was held by Susan Delgado. The blue dress, the tan skin, the triangles of color, too pale and perfect to be makeup, which ran lightly up her cheeks, most of all her hair, which was unbound tonight and fell to her waist like a shimmer of palest silk. He wanted her, suddenly and completely, with a desperate depth of feeling that felt like sickness. Everything he was and everything he had come for, it seemed, was secondary to her. She turned a little then and spied him. Her eyes, they were gray, he saw, widened the tiniest bit. He thought that the color in her cheeks deepened a little. Her lips, lips that had touched his as they stood on a dark road, he thought, with wonder, parted a little. Then the man standing next to Thorin, also tall, also skinny, with a mustache and long white hair lying on the dark shoulders of his coat, said something, and she turned back to him. A moment later, the group around Thorin was laughing, Susan included. The man with the white hair didn't join them, but smiled thinly. Roland, hoping his face did not give away the fact that his heart was pounding like a hammer, was led directly to this group, which stood close to the punch bowls. Distantly, he could feel Reimer's bony confederation of fingers clamped to his arm above the elbow. More clearly, he could smell mingled perfumes, the oil from the lamps on the walls, the aroma of the ocean, and thought for no reason at all, "Oh, I am dying, I am dying!" "Take hold of yourself, Roland of Gilead. Stop this foolishness, for your father's sake. Take hold." He tried, to some degree succeeded, and knew he would be lost the next time she looked at him. It was her eyes. The other night, in the dark, he hadn't been able to see those fog-colored eyes. "I didn't know how lucky I was," he thought wryly. "Mayor Thorin," Reimer asked, "may I present our guests from the inner baronies?" Thorin turned away from the man with the long white hair and the woman standing next to him, his face brightening. He was shorter than his chancellor, but just as thin, and his build was peculiar, a short and narrow-shouldered upper body over impossibly long and skinny legs. He looked, Roland thought, like the sort of bird you should glimpse in a marsh at dawn, bobbing for its breakfast. "Ah, you may!" he cried in a strong, high voice. "Indeed you may. We've been waiting with impatience, great impatience, for this moment. Well met we are, very well met. Welcome, sirs. May your evening in this house of which I am the fleeting proprietor be happy, and may your days be long upon the earth." Roland took the bony, outstretched hand, heard the knuckles crack beneath his grip, looked for an expression of discomfort on the mayor's face, and was relieved to see none. He bowed low over his outstretched leg. "William Dearborn, Mayor Thorin, at your service. Thank you for your welcome, and may your own days be long upon the earth." Arthur Heath made his manners next, then Richard Stockworth. Thorin's smile widened at each deep bow. Reimer did his best to beam, but looked unused to it. The man with the long white hair took a glass of punch, passed it to his female companion, and continued to smile thinly. Roland was aware that everyone in the room, the guests numbered perhaps 50 in all, was looking at them, but what he felt most upon his skin, beating like a soft wing, was her regard. He could see the blue silk of her dress from the side of one eye, but did not dare look at her more directly.
"Was your trip difficult?" Thorin was asking. "Did you have adventures and experience perils? We would hear all the details at dinner, so we would, for we have few guests from the Inner Ark these days."
His eager, slightly fatuous smile faded. His tufted brows drew together.
"Did you encounter patrols of Farson?"
"No, Excellency," Roland said.
"Nay, lad, nay. No, Excellency, I won't have it, and the fisherfolk and Hostrovers I serve wouldn't, even if I would. Just Mayor Thorin, if you please."
"Thank you. We saw many strange things on our journey, Mayor Thorin, but no good men."
"Good men?" Rhymer jerked out, and his upper lip lifted in a smile which made him look dog-like. "Good men, indeed."
"We would hear it all, every word," Thorin said. "But before I forget my manners in my eagerness, young gentlemen, let me introduce you to those close around me. Kimba, you've met. This formidable fellow to my left is Eldred Jonas, chief of my newly installed security staff."
Thorin's smile looked momentarily embarrassed.
"I'm not convinced that I need extra security. Sheriff Avery's always been quiet enough to keep the peace in our corner of the world, but Kimba insists. And when Kimba insists, the mayor must bow."
"Very wise, sir," Rhymer said, and bowed himself.
They all laughed, save for Jonas, who simply held on to his narrow smile.
Jonas nodded.
"Please, gents, I'm sure."
The voice was a reedy quaver. He then wished them long days upon the earth, all three, coming to Roland last in his round of handshaking. His grip was dry and firm, utterly untouched by the tremor in his voice. And now Roland noticed the queer blue shape tattooed on the back of the man's right hand, in the webbing between thumb and first finger. It looked like a coffin.
"Long days, pleasant nights," Roland said with hardly a thought.
It was a greeting from his childhood, and it was only later that he would realize it was one more apt to be associated with Gilead than with any such rural place as Hemphill. Just a small slip, but he was beginning to believe that their margin for such slips might be a good deal less than his father had thought when he had sent Roland here to get him out of Martin's way.
"And to you,"
Jonas said. His bright eyes measured Roland with a thoroughness that was close to insolence, still holding his hand. Then he released it and stepped back.
"Cordelia Delgado,"
Mayor Thorin said, next bowing to the woman who had been speaking to Jonas. As Roland also bowed in her direction, he saw the family resemblance, except that what looked generous and lovely on Susan's face looked pinched and folded on the face before him now. Not the girl's mother. Roland guessed that Cordelia Delgado was a bit too young for that.
"And our especial friend, Miss Susan Delgado," Thorin finished, sounding flustered.
Roland supposed she would have that effect on any man, even an old one like the mayor. Thorin urged her forward, bobbing his head and grinning, one of his knuckle-choked hands pressed against the small of her back, and Roland felt an instant of poisonous jealousy. Ridiculous, given this man's age and his plump, pleasant wife. But it was there, all right, and it was sharp. Sharp as a bee's ass, Court would have said. Then her face tilted up to his, and he was looking into her eyes again. He had heard of drowning in a woman's eyes in some poem or story, and thought it ridiculous. He still thought it ridiculous, but understood it was perfectly possible nonetheless. And she knew it. He saw concern in her eyes, perhaps even fear.
"Promise me that if we meet at Mayor's house, we meet for the first time."
The memory of those words had a sobering, clarifying effect, and seemed to widen his vision a little. Enough for him to be aware that the woman beside Jonas, the one who shared some of Susan's features, was looking at the girl with a mixture of curiosity and alarm. He bowed low, but did little more than touch her ringless, outstretched hand. Even so, he felt something like a spark jump between their fingers. From the momentary widening of those eyes, he thought that she felt it too.
"Pleased to meet you, Si," he said.
His attempt to be casual sounded tinny and false in his own ears. Still, he was begun. It felt like the whole world was watching him, them, and there was nothing to do but go on with it. He tapped his throat 3 times. "May your days be long,
aye, and yours, Mr. Dearborn. Thank you, Si."
She turned to Elaine with a rapidity that was almost rude, then to Cuthbert, who bowed, tapped, then said gravely,
"Might I recline briefly at your feet, miss? Your beauty has loosened my knees. I'm sure a few moments spent looking up at your profile from below with the back of my head on these cool tiles would put me right."
They all laughed at that, even Jonas and Miss Cordelia. Susan blushed prettily and slapped the back of Cuthbert's hand. For once Roland blessed his friend's relentless sense of foolery. Another man joined the party by the punch bowl. This newcomer was blocky and blessedly unthin in his boxtail coat. His cheeks burned with high color that looked like windburn rather than drink, and his pale eyes lay in nets of wrinkles. A rancher, Roland had ridden often enough with his father to know the look.
"There'll be maids aplenty to meet you boys tonight," the newcomer said with a friendly enough smile. "You'll find yourselves drunk on perfume if you're not careful. But I'd like my crack at you before you meet him. Friend Lingle, at your service."
His grip was strong and quick. No bowing or other nonsense went with it.
"I own the Rocking Bee, or it owns me, whichever way you want to look at it. I'm also boss of the Horsemen's Association, at least till they fire me. The barquet was my idea. Hope it's all right."
"It's perfect, sir," Alan said. "Clean and dry and room for 20. Thank you. You've been too kind."
"Nonsense," Langle said, looking pleased all the same as he knocked back a glass of punch. "We're all in this together, boy. John Farson's but one bad straw in a field of wrong-headedness these days. The world's moved on, folks say."
"So it has, aye, and a good piece down the road to hell is where it's moved on, too. Our job is to hold the hay out of the furnace as well as we can, as long as we can. For the sake of our children, even more than for that of our fathers."
"Hear, hear,"
Mayor Thorin said, in a voice that strove for the high ground of solemnity and fell with a splash into fatuity instead. Roland noted the scrawny old fellow was gripping one of Susan's hands. She seemed almost unaware of it, was looking intently at Langill instead. And suddenly he understood. The mayor was either her uncle or perhaps a cousin of some close degree. Langille ignored both, looking at the 3 newcomers instead, scrutinizing each in turn, and finishing with Roland.
"Anything us and mages can do to help, lad, just ask. Me, John Croydon, Hash Renfrew, Jake White, Hank Wertner, any or all. You'll meet 'em tonight, aye, their wives and sons and daughters as well, and you need only ask. We may be a good piece out from the hub of New Canaan here, but we're strong for the affiliation all the same, aye, very strong."
"Well spoken," Rhymer said quietly.
"And now," Langle said, "we'll toast your arrival proper. And you've had to wait too long already for a dip of punch. It's dry as dust you must be."
He turned to the punch bowls and reached for the ladle in the larger and more ornate of the 2, waving off the attendant, clearly wanting to honor them by serving them himself. "Mr. Langle," Roland said quietly. Yet there was a force of command in that voice. Fran Langle heard it and turned. "The smaller bowl is soft punch, is it not?" Langle considered this, at first not understanding. Then his eyebrow went up. For the first time he seemed to consider Roland and the others not as living symbols of the affiliation and the inner baronies, but as actual human beings. Young ones, only boys when you got right down to it.
"Aye?"
"Draw ours from that, if you'd be so kind." He felt all eyes upon them now, her eyes particularly. He kept his own firmly fixed on the rancher. But his peripheral vision was good, and he was very aware that Jonas's thin smile had resurfaced. Jonas knew what this was about already. Roland supposed Thorin and Rhymer did as well. These country mice knew a lot, more than they should, and he would need to think about that carefully later. It was the least of his concerns at the current moment, however. "We have forgotten the faces of our fathers, in a matter that has some bearing on our posting to Hambry," Roland was uncomfortably aware that he was now making a speech, like it or not. It wasn't the whole room he was addressing, thank the gods for little blessings, but the circle of listeners had grown well beyond the original group. Yet there was nothing for it but to finish. The boat was launched. I needn't go into details, nor would you expect them, I know, but I should say that we promised not to indulge in spirits during our time here, as penance, you see. Her gaze. He could still feel it on his skin, it seemed. For a moment there was complete quiet in the little group around the punch bowls, and then Lengil said, "Your father would be proud to hear you speak so frank, Will Dearborn. Aye, so he would. And what boy worth his salt didn't get up to a little noise and wind from time to time?" He clapped Roland on the shoulder, and although the grip of his hand was firm and his smile looked genuine, his eyes were hard to read, only gleams of speculation deep in those beds of wrinkles. "In his place, may I be proud for him?" "Yes," Roland said, smiling in return, "and with my thanks." "And mine," Cuthbert said. "Mine as well," Alan said quietly, taking the offered cup of soft punch and bowing to Lengil. Lengil filled more cups and handed them rapidly around. Those already holding cups found them plucked away and replaced with fresh cups of the soft punch. When each of the immediate group had one, Lengil turned, apparently intending to offer the toast himself. Rymer tapped him on the shoulder, shook his head slightly, and cut his eyes toward the mayor. That worthy was looking at them, with his eyes rather popped and his jaw slightly dropped. To Roland he looked like an enthralled playgoer in a penny seat. All he needed was a lapful of orange peel. Lengil followed the Chancellor's glance, and then nodded. Rymer next caught the eye of the guitar player standing at the center of the musicians. He stopped playing, so did the others. The guests looked that way, then back to the center of the room when Thorin began speaking. There was nothing ridiculous about his voice when he put it to use as he now did. It was carrying and pleasant.
"Ladies and gentlemen, my friends," he said, "I would ask you to help me in welcoming three new friends, young men from the inner baronies, fine young men who have dared great distances and many perils on behalf of the affiliation and in the service of order and peace."
Susan Delgado set her punch cup aside, retrieved her hand with some difficulty from her uncle's grip, and began to clap. Others joined in. The applause which swept the room was brief but warm. Eldred Jonas did not, Roland noticed, put his cup aside to join in. Thorin turned to Roland, smiling. He raised his cup.
"May I set you on with a word, Will Dearborn?"
"Aye, so you may, and with thanks," Roland said. There was laughter and fresh applause at his usage. Thorin raised his cup even higher. Everyone else in the room followed suit. Crystal gleamed like star points in the light of the chandelier.
"Ladies and gentlemen, I give you William Dearborn of Hemp Hill, Richard Stockworth of Pendleton, and Arthur Heath of Gilead."
Gasps and murmurs at that last, as if their mayor had announced Arthur Heath of Heaven.
"Take of them well, give to them well, make their days in Magus sweet, and their memories sweeter. Help them in their work, and to advance the causes which are so dear to all of us. May their days be long upon the earth, so says your mayor."
"So say we all," they thundered back. Thorin drank. The rest followed his example. There was fresh applause. Roland turned, helpless to stop himself, and found Susan's eyes again at once. For a moment she looked at him fully, and in her frank gaze he saw that she was nearly as shaken by his presence as he was by hers. Then the older woman, who looked like her, bent and murmured something into her ear. Susan turned away, her face a composed mask, but he had seen her regard in her eyes, and thought again that what was done might be undone, and what was spoken might be unspoken. 8. As they passed into the dining hall, which had tonight been set with four long trestle tables, so close there was barely room to move between them, Cordelia tugged her niece's hand, pulling her back from the mayor and Jonas, who had fallen into conversation with Fran Lengill.
"Why looked you at him so, miss?"
Cordelia whispered furiously. The vertical line had appeared on her forehead. Tonight it looked as deep as a trench.
"What ails thy pretty, stupid head?"
Thy. Just that was enough to tell Susan that her aunt was in a fine rage.
"Looked at who? And how?"
Her tone sounded right, she thought. But oh, her heart. The hand over hers clamped down, hurting.
"Play no fiddle with me, Miss Oh So Young and Pretty. Have ye ever seen that fine turned row of pins before? Tell me the truth."
"No, how could I? Aunt, you're hurting me."
Aunt Cord smiled balefully and clamped down harder.
"Better a small hurt now than a large one later. Curb your impudence and curb your flirtatious eyes."
"Aunt, I don't know what you—"
"I think you do,"
Cordelia said grimly, pressing her niece close to the wood paneling to allow the guests to stream past them. When the rancher who owned the boathouse next to theirs said hello, Aunt Cord smiled pleasantly at him and wished him good even before turning back to Susan.
"Mind me, miss. Mind me well. If I saw your cow's eyes, ye may be sure that half the company saw. Well, what's done is done, but it stops now. Your time for such child-made games is over, do you understand?"
Susan was silent, her face setting in those stubborn lines Cordelia hated most of all. It was an expression that always made her feel like slapping her headstrong niece until her nose bled and her great gray doe's eyes gushed tears.
"Ye've made a vow and a contract. Papers have been passed, the weird woman has been consulted, money has changed hands, and ye have given your promise. If that means nothing to such as yourself, girl, remember what it did mean to your father."
Tears rose in Susan's eyes again, and Cordelia was glad to see them. Her brother had been an improvident irritation, capable of producing only this far too pretty woman-child. But he had his uses, even dead.
"Now promise ye'll keep your eyes to yourself, and that if ye see that boy coming, ye'll swing wide, aye, wide as you can, to stay out of his way."
"I promise, Aunt," Susan whispered, "I do."
Cordelia smiled. She was really quite pretty when she smiled.
"It's well, then. Let's go in. We're being looked at. Hold my arm, child."
Susan clasped her aunt's powdered arm. They entered the room side by side, their dresses rustling, the sapphire pendant on the swell of Susan's breast flashing. And many there were who remarked upon how alike they looked, and how well pleased poor old Pat Delgado would have been with them. 9. Roland was seated near the head of the center table, between Hash Renfrew, a rancher even bigger and blockier than Lengill, and Thorin's rather morose sister, Coral. Renfrew had been handy with the punch. Now, as the soup was brought to table, he set about proving himself equally adept with the ale. He talked about the fishing trade.
"Not what it used to be, boy, although it's less muties they pull up in their nets these days, and that's a blessing.
The farming trade.
Folks around here can grow most anything, long as it's corn or beans."
And finally about those things clearly closest to his heart, horsin', coursin', and ranchin'. Those businesses went on as always, aye, so they did, although times had been hard in the grass and seacoast baronies for 40 years or more. Weren't the bloodlines clarifying, Roland asked, for they had begun to do so where he came from.
"Aye," Renfrew agreed, ignoring his potato soup and gobbling barbecued beef strips instead. These he scooped up with a bare hand and washed down with more ale. "Aye, young master, bloodlines was clarifying wonderful well. Indeed they were. 3 colts out of every 5 were threaded stock, in thoroughbred as well as common lines, can it? And the 4th could be kept and worked, if not bred. Only 1 in 5 these days born with extra legs or extra eyes or its guts on the outside, and that was good. But the birth rates were way down, so they were. The stallions had as much ram as ever in their ramrods, it seemed, but not as much powder and ball."
"Begging your pardon, ma'am," Renfrew said, leaning briefly across Roland to Coral Thorin.
She smiled her thin smile, it reminded Roland of Jonas's, trudged her spoon through her soup, and said nothing. Renfrew emptied his ale cup, smacked his lips heartily, and held the cup out again. As it was recharged, he turned back to Roland. Things weren't good, not as they once had been, but they could be worse. Would be worse if that bugger Farson had his way. This time he didn't bother excusing himself to Cy Thorin. They all had to pull together. That was the ticket, rich and poor, great and small, while pulling could still do some good. And then he seconded Lengil, telling Roland that whatever he and his friends wanted, whatever they needed, they had only to name it.
Information should be enough, Roland said. Numbers of things.
I can't be a counter without numbers, Renfrew agreed and sprayed beery laughter.
On Roland's left hand, Coral Thorin nibbled a bit of green, the beef strip she had not so much as touched, smiled her narrow smile, and went on boating with her spoon. Roland guessed there was nothing wrong with her ears, though, and that her brother might get a complete report of their conversation. Or possibly it would be Rymer to get the report. For while it was too early to say for sure, Roland had an idea that Rymer might be the real force here, along perhaps with Cy Jonas.
For instance, Roland said, how many riding horses do you think we may be able to report back to the affiliation?
Tithe or total?
Total.
Renfrew put his cup down and appeared to calculate. As he did, Roland looked across the table and saw Lengel and Henry Wertner, the barony's stockliner, exchange a quick glance. They had heard. And he saw something else as well when he returned his attention to his seatmate. Hash Renfrew was drunk, but likely not as drunk as he wanted young Will Dearborn to believe.
Total, you say? Not just what we owe the affiliation or might be able to send along in a pinch.
Yes.
Well, let's see, young Cy. Fran must run 140 head. John Croydon's got near 100. Hank Wertner's got 40 on his own hook and must run 60 more out along the drop for the barony. Government hoss flesh, Mr. Dearborn.
Roland smiled. I know it well. Split hoofs, low necks, no speed, bottomless bellies.
Renfrew laughed hard at that, nodding. But Roland found himself wondering if the man was really amused. In Hambry, the waters on top and the waters down below seemed to run in different directions.
As for myself, I've had a bad 10 or 12 years, sand eye, brain fever, cabards. At one time there's 200 head of running horses out there on the drop with a lazy Susan brand on them. Now there can't be more than 80.
Roland nodded. So we're speaking of 420 head.
Oh, more than that, Renfrew said with a laugh.
He went to pick up his ale cup, struck it with the side of one work and weather-reddened hand, knocked it over, cursed, picked it up, then cursed the ale boy who came slow to refill it.
More than that?
Roland prompted when Renfrew was finally cocked and locked and ready to resume action.
You have to remember, Mr. Dearborn, that this is hoss country more'n it's fisher country. We josh each other, we and the fishers, but there's many a scale scraper got a nag put away behind his house, or in the barony stables if they have no roof of their own to keep the rain off a hoss's head. 'Twas her poor dad used to keep the barony stables.
Renfrew nodded toward Susan, who was seated across and three seats up from Roland himself, just a table's turn from the mayor, who was, of course, seated at the head. Roland found her placement there passing peculiar, especially given the fact that the mayor's missus had been seated almost all the way at the far end of the table, with Cuthbert on one side of her and some rancher to whom they had not yet been introduced on her other. Roland supposed an old fellow like Thorin might like to have a pretty young relation near at hand to help draw attention to him or to cheer up his own eye. But it still seemed odd. Almost an insult to one's wife. If he was tired of her conversation, why not put her at the head of another table? They have their own customs, that's all. And the customs of the country aren't your concern. This man's crazy horse count is your concern.
How many other running horses would you say, he asked Renfrew, in all?
Renfrew gazed at him shrewdly.
An honest answer will not come back to haunt me, will it, sonny? I'm an affiliation man, so I am affiliation to the core. I'll carve Excalibur on my gravehead like as not. But I'd not see Hambry and Magus stripped of all its treasure.
That won't happen, Cy.
How could we force you to give up what you don't want to in any case? Such forces as we have are all committed in the north and west against the good man.
Renfrew considered this, then nodded. And may I not be Will to you?
Renfrew brightened, nodded, and offered his hand a second time.
He grinned broadly when Roland this time shook it in both of his, the over-and-under grip preferred by drovers and cowboys.
These are bad times we live in, Will, and they've bred bad manners. I'd guess there's probably another 150 head of horse in and about Mages. Good ones, is what I mean.
Big Hat Stock. Renfrew nodded, clapped Roland on the back, ingested a goodly quaff of ale.
Big Hats, aye.
From the top of their table there came a burst of laughter. Jonas had apparently said something funny. Susan laughed without reservation, her head tilted back and her hands clasped before the sapphire pendant. Cordelia, who sat with the girl on her left and Jonas on her right, was also laughing. Thorin was absolutely convulsed, rocking back and forth in his chair, wiping his eyes with a napkin.
"Yon's a lovely girl," Renfrew said. He spoke almost reverently.
Roland could not quite swear that a small sound, a womanly hum, perhaps, had come from his other side. He glanced in that direction and saw Cy Thorin still sporting with her soup. He looked back toward the head of the table.
"Is the mayor her uncle, or perhaps her cousin?" Roland asked.
What happened next had a heightened clarity in his memory, as if someone had turned up all the colors and sounds of the world. The velvet swags behind Susan suddenly seemed a brighter red. The caw of laughter which came from Coral Thorin was the sound of a breaking branch. It was surely loud enough to make everyone in the vicinity stop their conversations and look at her, Roland thought, except only Renfrew and the two ranchers across the table did.
Her uncle!
It was her first conversation of the evening.
Her uncle! That's good, eh, Rennie?
Renfrew said nothing, only pushed his ale cup away and finally began to eat his soup.
"I'm surprised at you, young man. So I am. You may be from the in-world. But, oh, goodness, whoever tended to your education of the real world, the one outside of books and maps, stopped a mite short, I'd say. She's his..."
And then a word so thick with dialect that Roland had no idea what it was.
"Seafin," it sounded, or perhaps "Sheevin."
"I beg pardon?" He was smiling, but the smile felt cold and false on his mouth. There was a heaviness in his belly, as if the punch and the soup and the single beef strip he had eaten for politeness' sake had all lumped together in his stomach.
"Do you serve?" he'd asked her, meaning did she serve at table. Mayhap she did serve, but likely she did it in a room rather more private than this.
Suddenly he wanted to hear no more, had not the slightest interest in the meaning of the word the mayor's sister had used. Another burst of laughter rocked the top of the table. Susan laughed with her head back, her cheeks glowing, her eyes sparkling. One strap of her dress had slipped down her arm, disclosing the tender hollow of her shoulder. As he watched, his heart full of fear and longing, she brushed it absently back into place with the palm of her hand.
"It means quiet, little woman," Renfrew said, clearly uncomfortable. "It's an old term, not used much these days."
"Stop it, Rennie," said Carl Thorin. Then, to Roland, "He's just an old cowboy and can't quit shoveling horse shit even when he's away from his beloved nags. Sheevin means sidewife. In the time of my great-grandmother, it meant whore, but one of a certain kind."
She looked with a pale eye at Susan, who was now sipping ale, then turned back to Roland. There was a species of baleful amusement in her gaze, an expression that Roland liked little.
"The kind of whore you had to pay for in coin. The kind too fine for the trade of simple folk."
"She's his Jilly?" Roland asked, through lips which felt as if they had been iced.
"Aye," Coral said.
Not consummated, not until the reap, and none too happy about that is my brother, I'll warrant. But bought and paid for, just as in the old days, so she is.
Coral paused, then said,
Her father would die of shame if he could see her.
She spoke with a kind of melancholy satisfaction.
I hardly think we should judge the mayor too harshly, Renfrew said in an embarrassed, pontificating voice.
Coral ignored him. She studied the line of Susan's jaw, the soft swell of her bosom above the silken edge of her bodice, the fall of her hair. The thin humor was gone from Coral Thorin's face. In it now was a somehow chilling species of contempt. In spite of himself, Roland found himself imagining the mayor's knuckle-bunchy hands pushing down the straps of Susan's dress, crawling over her naked shoulders, plunging like gray crabs into the cave beneath her hair. He looked away toward the table's lower end, and what he saw there was no better. It was Olive Thorin that his eye found. Olive, who had been relegated to the foot of the table. Olive, looking up at the laughing folk who sat at its head. Looking up at her husband, who had replaced her with a beautiful young girl and gifted that girl with a pendant which made her own fire-dim earrings look dowdy by comparison. There was none of Coral's hatred and angry contempt on her face. Looking at her might have been easier if that were so. She only gazed at her husband with eyes that were humble, hopeful, and unhappy. Now Roland understood why he had thought her sad. She had every reason to be sad. More laughter from the mayor's party. Reimer had leaned over from the next table where he was presiding to contribute some witticism. It must have been a good one. This time even Jonas was laughing. Susan put a hand to her bosom, then took her napkin and raised it to wipe a tear of laughter from the corner of her eye. Thorin covered her other hand. She looked toward Roland and met his eyes, still laughing. He thought of Olive Thorin sitting down there at the foot of the table with the salt and spices, an untouched bowl of soup before her, and that unhappy smile on her face, seated where the girl could see her as well. And he thought that had he been wearing his guns, he might well have drawn one and put a bullet in Susan Delgado's cold and whoring little heart. And thought, who do you hope to fool? Then one of the serving boys was there, putting a plate of fish in front of him. Roland thought he had never felt less like eating in his life. But he would eat, just the same, just as he would turn his mind to the questions raised by his conversation with Hash Renfrew of the Lazy Susan Ranch. He would remember the face of his father. Yes, I'll remember it very well, he thought. If only I could forget the one above yon sapphire. 10. The dinner was interminable, and there was no escape afterward. The table at the center of the reception room had been removed, and when the guests came back that way, like a tide which has surged as high as it can and now ebbs, they formed two adjacent circles at the direction of a sprightly little red-haired man, whom Cuthbert later dubbed Mayor Thorin's Minister of Fun. The boy-girl, boy-girl, boy-girl circling was accomplished with much laughter and some difficulty. Roland guessed that about three-quarters of the guests were now fairly well shottered. And then the guitarist struck up a caissa. This proved to be a simple sort of reel. The circles revolved in opposite directions, all holding hands, until the music stopped for a moment. Then the couple created, at the place where the two circles touched, danced at the center of the female partner's circle, while everyone else clapped and cheered. The lead musician managed this old and clearly well-loved tradition with a keen eye to the ridiculous, stopping his muchachos in order to create the most amusing couples. Tall woman, short man, fat woman, skinny man, old woman, young man. Cuthbert ended up sidekicking with a woman as old as his great-granddam, to the sigh's breathless cackles and the company's general roars of approval. Then, just when Roland was thinking this stupid dance would never end, the music stopped, and he found himself facing Susan Delgado. For a moment he could do nothing but stare at her, feeling that his eyes must burst from their sockets, feeling that he could move neither of his stupid feet.
Then she raised her arms, the music began, the circle, this one included Mayor Thorin, and the watchful, narrowly smiling Eldred Jonas applauded, and he led her into the dance. At first, as he spun her through a figure, his feet moved with all their usual grace and precision, numb or not. He felt like a man made of glass. Then he became aware of her body touching his, and the rustle of her dress, and he was all too human again. She moved closer for a moment, and when she spoke, her breath tickled in his ear. He wondered if a woman could drive you mad, literally mad. He wouldn't have believed so before tonight. But tonight everything had changed.
"Thank you for your discretion and your propriety," she whispered.
He pulled back from her a little, and at the same time twirled her, his hand against the small of her back, palm resting on cool satin, fingers touching warm skin. Her feet followed his with never a pause or stutter. They moved with perfect grace, unafraid of his great and booted clod-stompers, even in their flimsy silk slippers. "I can be discreet, Sai," he said. "As for propriety, I'm amazed you even know the word." She looked up into his cold face, her smile fading. He saw anger come in to fill it, but before anger there was hurt, as if he had slapped her. He felt both glad and sorry at the same time.
"Why do you speak so?" she whispered.
The music stopped before he could answer, although how he might have answered he had no idea. She curtsied and he bowed, while those surrounding them clapped and whistled. They went back to their places, to their separate circles, and the guitars began again. Roland felt his hands grasped on either side and began to turn with the circle once more. Laughing, kicking, clapping on the beat, feeling her somewhere behind him doing the same, wondering if she wanted as badly as he did to be out of here, to be in the dark, to be alone in the dark, where he could put his false face aside before the real one beneath could grow hot enough to set it afire.